From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for that support. For more information on how you can keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Happy New Year! As we say goodbye to what was such a painful, tumultuous year for so many, let's hope 2017 brings blessings and positive changes we can't even think to ask for yet. With the weekend full of commemoration and celebration, we're going to revisit some of our favorite conversations from past episodes of State of Belief Radio. Here's producer Ray Kirstein.
Thanks, Welton. As we step into 2017, we'll spend a few minutes back in the summer of 2013. In our nation's capital, a diverse group of faith leaders and supporters marched to the White House in protest of the numerous deportations that were occurring under the administration's watch. United Methodist Bishop Minerva Carcano led the procession and faith service and presented a petition which was signed by more than 4,000 people, calling on the president to halt all deportations. The denomination's official spokesperson on immigration, Bishop Carcano, was on our show to talk about the moral and justice components of deportation. And 2010 interview with Blair Scott, at the time communications director of American Atheists, on that organization's public billboard campaign calling Christmas a myth. Similar campaigns made headlines around the holidays this year as well. What do coffee, ice cream, the poet Rumi, and the Alamo have in common? We'll remind you with a 2008 interview with author Jonathan Curiel, talking about his book, Al-America, Travels Through America's Arab and Islamic Roots. But we begin with a 2009 conversation with Nicholas Wade, who at the time was the New York Times science writer. He was on State of Belief to discuss his book, The Faith Instinct, How Religion Evolved and Why It Endures.
Now, how does one explain the universality of this practice of religion? According to a new book, the answer lies in human evolution. The book is called The Faith Instinct, How Religion Evolved and Why It Endures. The book is written by New York Times science reporter Nicholas Wade. Religion, as Wade writes, played such a positive role in early societies, binding people together, creating a moral fabric, that it became ingrained in human nature. Humans essentially became hardwired for faith. Joining me right now to talk more about this subject is Nicholas Wade. Nicholas, thanks for being with us on State of Belief.
Thanks for inviting me.
Now, what evidence do you see for the existence of what you call the faith instinct?
Well, the best evidence is that, as you mentioned just now, religion is universal. So it's an ancient behavior, but it's found in every society throughout the world, which strongly suggests that it has a biological or a genetic basis.
I often quote my friend Karen Armstrong on this show when she says that all the world's religions boil down to the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. She sees that as evidence that compassion can be found at the heart of all religion. You seem to be saying, and I certainly don't want to put words in your mouth, that this golden rule actually had very practical implications in that it helped societies survive. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, that is correct. But I have I put it slightly differently from the way Karen does. I think the moral instinct is separate from the religious instinct. I think we do have a moral instinct, and you can see the beginnings of it in monkey and ape societies. But there's a difference between knowing what is right and actually doing it. And I think the religious instinct came along later in our evolution and was a way of enforcing what is there in the moral instinct of placing in people's minds the idea of a divine overseer who would punish them severely if they didn't follow their inner moral leanings.
So in some ways, the religion instinct, the instinct of faith, is even stronger.
Yes, it's more encompassing than the moral instinct. it has a more general purpose, which is essentially to give group cohesion to a society, to get everyone on the same page, emotionally committed to doing whatever it is that the society needs to do to survive. So that includes the moral, sustaining the moral fabric internally, and externally it means being willing to defend the society against others.
Are you arguing at all that an early society of atheists would not have survived?
I think that is exactly the implication, that in these early societies, the pace of warfare was very intense, and the only ones that survived were those that had a strong religious instinct, and we are the descendants of those survivors. Now, the situation in modern societies is a little different. I think you need a society to have some religious instinct, some way of sustaining the moral fabric, but on an individual basis, it doesn't make a lot of difference if many members of that society are agnostics or atheists.
I talk with a lot of people today who say they have nothing to do with organized religion, but personal spirituality is extremely important to them. Where do they fit into this?
Well, I think they fit in because, as I argue, everyone has this sort of yearning for religion, this willingness to emotionally commit to the religion of their community built into their genes, into their neural circuits. So usually this happens around the age of puberty. That's when people are confirmed or bar mitzvahed. That's when people went through initiation rites in primitive societies. And that's when religion is meant to be learned. There's a sort of biological window for it, just as there's a biological window for learning language. Now, if you don't learn religion during that window, maybe, I think for many people, you're still left with that sort of residual yearning for spirituality, for the belief there must be something out there larger than ourselves. And that's why so many people without a formal religion, nonetheless, are still trying to find one.
You have a fascinating chapter in the book in which you write about religion and commerce. You say that as a society evolved from hunter-gatherer to settled societies, that religion was key to setting up early economies. Now, how is that so?
Well, religion was the method of government for primitive societies. It did absolutely everything that these early societies needed to do to get them organized. So one of the things they did was to sort of trade things between each other, and that was done on the basis of trust. And the way you set up trusts in primitive groups was to do it within the framework of religion. So many primitive peoples have exchanges like the potlatch ceremonies of the West Coast Indians, which are embedded in a religious framework. And modern societies have followed the sort of general tendency of creating secular institutions that take over the role of religion. But often when you scratch the surface just a little, you find religion is still there. And I think this is probably true of the transactions that take place in modern societies. I mean, it's true we have the courts and the police for sort of policing and monitoring things that go wrong, but you can't possibly do that with every transaction. So, you know, the guy you meet in a store, the stranger you meet in the street, or your interactions with them are sort of governed by this basis of trust. And if you try and trace that further back, well, where does this basis for trust come, which is kind of extraordinary when you think that it sort of exists between complete strangers in a large city like New York. I think the answer is basically that it comes from ideas of morality that are enforced by ideas of religion.
How do you say what you do, which I'm not questioning, but how do you say what you do without turning religion into a means to an end when a lot of people think religion is somewhat an end in itself?
Well, that's a very good question. I do argue in the book that religion is a means to an end. It's a means to giving us group cohesion, which is very hard to obtain in other ways. And then I argue it's up to each society as to how it uses that group cohesion, whether for good or for bad ends. That I think is what natural selection has seen. So That I would say is the evolutionary perspective on religion. But I should hasten to add that cannot be the whole story. It's just part of the story.
Mm-hmm. I know you see the same polls that I see here in the United States. More and more people are gravitating away from organized religion. Church attendance is decreasing. All the major denominations are losing members. What does this tell you about religion and evolution, and particularly what does it mean for the future of religion?
Well, I think it's very hard to say. I mean, the first thing one might observe is that the United States is still a far, far more religious country than most states of Europe that have been rapidly secularizing in the last 50 years. There is a sort of downward blip in church attendance, whether it means a great deal for the religiosity of the United States, I don't know. I do believe that since religion is sort of imprinted in our neural circuits, it's never going to go away. But I wouldn't be surprised if it sort of waxes and wanes according to particular circumstances. I think certainly in the United States, one of the features of our religion which is very interesting is that we have lots of different sects, all of which compete with each other, but in a sort of perfectly peaceful way, which certainly contrasts with the situation in Europe, where there are often sort of wars with different sects on opposite sides. And now some people think that because we have these many different sects furiously competing for members with each other, that's what keeps religion alive in the United States. The competition creates, in economists' parlance, a demand for religion, and that's why there are more consumers of religion in the U.S., and that's what keeps religion so vital here compared with in England, for example, where if you get a sort of stipend from your bishop every week, the minister doesn't have to go out and hustle for customers. There's no competition. There's a monopoly, as it were. So religions in countries where there's only one religion don't have to try as hard as they do in this country.
Nicholas Wade has worked at the New York Times as an editorial writer, editor, and science reporter. His new book is called The Faith Instinct: How Religion Evolved and Why It Endures.
After retiring in 2012, Nicholas Wade continues to contribute to the New York Times. In 2014, he released A Troublesome Inheritance: Genes, Race, and Human History, a book that provoked coordinated criticism from part of the scientific community.
On this holiday weekend, you're hearing some of our favorite interviews from previous shows. Driving on Route 495 near the Lincoln Tunnel in New Jersey, one can't help but be taken aback by an unusual billboard. It features a manger, three wise men on camels, the stars shining bright over it, and over all of that, the caption, "You know it's a myth." With us is American Atheist Communications Director Blair Scott. He's going to help us understand this whole campaign better. Blair, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Let's begin with that question about objective. What is the objective of this campaign?
The objective of the campaign is not to go after Christians, what we call the 40 percenters, the people that believe in a literal creation, a literal Noachian flood, take the Bible literally. Mm-hmm. Those guys aren't our target audience. Our target audience is what Barna Research, which is a Christian-based research group based out of San Diego, calls the 7 percenters. Mm-hmm. And we think that number is much higher. But the 7 percenters are people that go to church but are atheists. And they go because they're just living the facade. They're keeping up the show for their family and friends, or they're going for the social aspect. Mm-hmm. They, as the billboard says, know it's a myth. Mm-hmm. But they continue to go to church. They continue to tithe 10% of their money to organizations that often work against their best interest. Mm-hmm. And we understand, as a side effect of that, we're going to offend some Christians, some mm-hmm. regular, everyday Christians. We understand that, and that's the risk we were willing to take. Because, like you alluded to, it is kind of tongue-in-cheek. You know, there was an old saying in the West, the Old West, that if you're going to be hung for being a horse thief, you might as well steal a horse. Right? I mean, for years, we've been accused of waging a war on Christmas when we never even lifted a finger, much less fired any kind of weapon, right?
Yeah.
So we decided this year, you know what? Let's let them see what a war on Christmas actually looks like.
Yeah. Well, Larry, is this just one billboard, or are there billboards in other places as well? How does that work?
This is the first billboard that we've put up. We are considering others. We haven't made that decision yet. I mean, other atheist billboards and other free thought and skeptic billboards have gone up throughout the United States. And that was another thing that led us to this is, I mean, across the United States, you have hundreds of thousands of Christian billboards advertising for churches. You know, you drive up the I-55 and, you know, in Missouri heading towards St. Louis, and there's billboard after billboard after billboard showing bloody fetuses. You know, and nobody says anything about those. But we put up one billboard, and pardon the expression, all hell breaks loose, right? But we realized earlier that these other billboards that have been put up by other organizations, they were very benign. They were just advertisements to our fellow atheists. You know, if you don't believe in God, you're not alone. There's an organization out there for you. Or just go to this webpage. Well, those were vandalized. People promoted boycotts against the advertising companies that put those billboards up. And so we realized it didn't matter what our message was. No matter what we say, people are going to be offended by just our very presence oftentimes.
Yeah.
You know, we're still advertising to our fellow atheists, but it's got a little more meat to it.
How do you want them to react? They see that, and is it that you're wanting them to say, you know, they're right, I don't believe all that, and maybe it's just time for me to be honest about it?
Yeah, that's essentially what we want. I mean, look, we can't force people out of the closet, and we have no intention of doing that. We just want people to think about it a little harder. We outnumber the Jewish population in the United States. We outnumber the Methodists, the Muslims combined. But the problem is we have no political power. We have no say in the course of America because so many of us are in a closet. And the fact that we're in the closet speaks volumes not about atheism, but about religion and the fear that those people have about the religious repercussions they'll face when they come out of the closet. If every atheist in the United States were to come out of the closet tomorrow, the political landscape would change overnight.
And what would it be, Blair? I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm saying that, well, may be true, but what would that new landscape look like?
I think you would see the stopping of, like, inserting creationism in public schools. You would have more people fighting that. You would see a better separation of church and state, you know, which protects everybody. I mean, separation of church and state doesn't just protect me. It protects the Baptist, the Methodist, the Mormon, the Hindu, the Buddhist. It protects all of us because it keeps the government out of our religions.
Right.
Look at how much politicians pander to religion. And they're pandering to a small evangelical minority. I mean, here in Alabama, where I live, every candidate, Democrat, Libertarian, Republican, it didn't matter. All their commercials were mostly about faith and religion because they knew that's what they had to do to win. But they don't have to do that to win. There's 20% of us out there that don't believe in that. And we outnumber the 10% of the vocal evangelicals. You know, how come nobody's pandering to us? Because we're not out of the closet. That's why they're not pandering to us.
Yeah. And you know what's ironic about what you're saying is that if you were doing this interview with me, and I am a Christian minister, I would be giving, in the last part of the conversation, most of the same answers you're giving. Because as you well know, many Americans don't know that the great supporters that pushed through religious freedom in our country came from a very odd coalition of atheists and agnostics and Baptists and Jews and Unitarians.
Correct.
Well, what kind of response are you getting?
Clearly, we're getting a lot of hate mail from some of the Christians out there. That was expected. We knew that was going to happen. Some of it's funny. Some of it's serious. Some of it we've had to look at and seriously consider whether we want to forward it to the proper authorities because of death threats. But from the atheist community, overwhelming support, obviously. And we, you know, we have a few atheist detractors. We can't be the atheist organization for everybody.
Blair Scott left American Atheists leadership in 2012.
Last Thursday, in our nation's capital, a diverse group of faith leaders and supporters marched to the White House, the culmination of a series of actions that began back in May 1st. actions designed to spur President Obama to stop the record level of deportations his administration has been executing, and to raise awareness of the moral and justice components of this important issue. Leading the procession, as well as a faith service, and presenting a petition signed by more than 4,000 people of faith, was Bishop Minerva Carcano, official spokesperson on immigration for the United Methodist Church. And we are very fortunate to have Bishop Carcano with us on State of Belief Radio today. Bishop, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here with you.
Would you start by talking about who's participating in terms of faith traditions and backgrounds?
Well, we've had about 100 leaders, immigrant leaders, from all across the country, Catholic, evangelical, Protestant, those who are between faith as well, mm-hmm. because of the impact of this kind of journey and because of where they find themselves in the shadows of society, not yet quite integrated. So it was a diverse group in terms of faith perspective. It was a group that represents the best leadership from among our immigrant community. Many of them were persons who are undocumented, some of them with ankle monitors, and so they're at a very precarious place in their journey, and others who have not yet been detected but were willing to come forth, even if this meant that somebody would recognize them and detain them because they feel the urgency of the moment to give a witness, not only to Congress, not only to President Obama, but to this country, about the fact that they represent a community of hardworking people, people of faith, people who want to make a contribution, and yet people who are living in the shadows and living under great fear, and they're experiencing greater and greater persecution and racism as well.
Bishop Carcano, how did you get them here? Who did the organizing?
A number of different organizations of immigrant rights groups, immigrant labor groups, so groups that are very active across the country, primarily under the leadership of Endelon, who does a lot of organizing with immigrant populations and immigrant worker rights groups. There is a growing coalition and network of those who stand with immigrants from the faith perspective, from the employment labor perspective and organizing perspective. Communities of immigrants are arising and saying enough. And the network that is being created will make a change and is making a change in this country.
Thursday was the closing of the rolling fast to call for change and how immigration policies are implemented. I'd like for you to talk about the origins of the fast on May 1st and how that worked and the tradition of nonviolent action that connects you to all of this.
Well, the fast is based on the fact that this is a movement of people of deep faith, people who know that when we fast before God, God hears our prayers. When we fast, it gives us an opportunity to put our lives into perspective. We quit paying attention to our carnal human needs in order to pay attention to something greater. And so immigrants and people who stand with them made the decision to take a break from those normal things we do to create space for reaching out to God, reaching out to others, paying attention to this critical moment in history and deciding how we're going to lead this country and our communities as well around immigration.
Has it worked for the people? I mean, do they feel empowered by this?
I saw it. I really saw it. And one of the pieces of empowerment was immigrant voices, immigrant men and women. A 13-year-old, Catherine Figueroa from Maricopa County in Arizona, a woman named Sandra, a young man from Vermont. Sandra's from Atlanta, young man from Vermont, young adult, all of whom said to me, if you had said to me a year ago that I would be speaking in Washington, D.C., I would have said there is not a single possibility. Mm-hmm. But the fast has empowered them, has given them strength to come forth, knowing that there's a whole national community fasting and praying has given them strength.
Mm. Have you seen anything that makes you think there might be a change of mind in the White House, or that there might be some leniency in which there's a cutback on deportations?
I'm not privy to that kind of internal conversation, but one note that continues to give me hope is the fact that a year ago, the president did take an action, an executive administrative action, to side with young immigrants, mm-hmm. with the Dreamers, and to say, we're going to allow them to stay. They are the future for their families, but also for this country, and we are living in a broken immigration system. So let's be the compassionate, just-filled country that we have a history of being, mm-hmm. and let's side with them. That continues to give me hope.
And I guess I'm pushing on this because I know it has to impact the way you do your work as well as the way you strategize about the future. But do you feel any of that compassion when you're in the White House?
I do. I do feel that compassion. I also feel a great concern around politics, the state of politics. And the state of politics is that there are congressional leaders who, if they see the president getting, in their opinion, too engaged, they shut the door just because it's the president, mm-hmm. just because it happens to be Barack Obama. And that is not a helpful way to lead this country
right.
at all. And so it's a stalemate situation. And this, among many other issues, are too critical to be dependent on these political games.
A lot of people are being hurt
yes.
by that stalemate.
Yes, exactly. We're stuck on health care. We're stuck on immigration reform, on the economy, and the list goes on.
You published a very moving article in Huffington Post this week headlined, Immigration, It's About Families. Talk a little more about that, if you will.
I woke up one night unable to sleep because of what I see happening around immigration reform in this country and wrote that article out of a need to just deal with the feelings I was having. I think they're feelings that many people in this country share. And that is the way that we have forgotten that this is about families. Immigration reform is about families. It's not about numbers. It's about families. It's about little children and young people, men and women who are here undergirding our economy, here because we've had some impact on their own economies from the countries they come from,
mm-hmm.
the impact of NAFTA and CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, the North American Free Trade Agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm concerned about them. I'm concerned about the militarization of the border, $46 billion to secure a border. When those border communities, and I have now served the whole extent of the border, and I have never been in a community that wanted those walls, and on either side. And so $46 billion, that is sinful. That is sinful. What message do we send to the world, not just to Mexico, but to the world? What message do we give our children here, that we secure the world by a wall, that we need to separate ourselves out from other people? It's the wrong message. It's the wrong investment of incredible resources. $46 billion could transform the economic situation of North and South America mm-hmm. if we chose to make that investment, and would do more to right this situation of immigration than anything else.
Yeah.
So those kinds of things led me to write that article.
Well, in the article, you wrote, these are immigrant men and women, children and young people who not only deserve better, but whose struggle will bring judgment upon this country for decades to come if we don't begin to treat them justly. Now, I know you want to stop deportations. What else is needed for this to comply as a justice-laced movement from the side of government?
If it were a just movement, it would be comprehensive, truly comprehensive immigration reform that would take into consideration how economic agreements in the region and globally have affected migration that comes into this country. I've mentioned NAFTA and CAFTA as two examples of that. NAFTA, one clear example, 2 million farmers were left destitute in Mexico because of the impact of NAFTA. So that kind of economic examination and correction is necessary. A pathway to citizenship for those immigrants who are already here. Those immigrants are here serving in this country. They've come here. They've contributed to the economy. They've contributed to our way of life. And they need to be recognized. If we set up a second class of citizenship, it begins to erode not only our families and our communities, but our democracy as well. The labor rights of persons need to be respected, need to be protected for any worker, be they documented or undocumented. Because again, if we don't respect the rights of workers, then we erode the rights of all workers. Those are some of the basic things. The reunification of families. We have many, many immigrant families. We have families where half of the family is documented and half is not. A mother, a father documented, children who are not, or vice versa. And yet they're separated because of our broken immigration policy. That needs to be corrected.
I tell you what, I listening to you, I don't see how they say no to you. You're very persuasive. So what's next in this? What comes after you go home this time?
We continue to pray, we continue to fast, and we continue to hold up the voice for justice. That's the role of communities of faith. As a Christian, Scripture is full of wonderful, wonderful examples of how we are to treat the immigrant, and we need to live that. And not just preach that. And so to continue to speak to Congress, continue to speak to the president, continue to speak to local city officials and county sheriffs like Joseph Arpaio and governors so that justice is done for our immigrant families. I'm concerned that the House of Representatives is stuck. I'm concerned that the bill that came out of the Senate was not the best effort in terms of the justice and moral dimensions of what we need to do to right the situation with our immigrant brothers and sisters. So we need to persist. The journey may be long, but we need to persist in all those ways.
You know, you have all of the information in your head. But what's most moving is what's in your heart. And it's perfectly obvious in talking to you that the power that's there. What has doing all of this done to you?
I believe deeply that it's made me a better person. A better daughter of God, a better servant of Christ as a Christian. I think it's opened my heart in a way that has made sense of life in a much deeper way and clearer way. This past week, I walked with a woman who was detained in the 8th month of her pregnancy and wears today an ankle monitor and has today a 1-month-old daughter. And she walked with her daughter, little, tiny, precious, beautiful girl named Evelyn. And I could not but feel like Evelyn was my daughter as well. And I want a better world for Evelyn and all the children that I've met along the way, immigrant children who have touched my life deeply, and immigrant brothers and sisters who have welcomed me in not only their homes, but into their families, and shown me the face of God in a way that I had not yet seen. And so I feel like I'm a better person and have more hope for the world because of the witness, that incarnational witness that immigrants have given to me.
I'm not a cynic. I'm a hopeful person. But yet I have to be realistic and say that
this Congress has said no so many times or just has not done anything, you may be disappointed. This is not a counseling session, but if you are, please don't stop.
Oh, thank you. And I won't stop, and I don't stop, because while I may be disappointed with Congress, I'm never disappointed with God. And I see God at work, and God has the last word.
Yeah. Bishop Carcano, I know it's been an extraordinarily busy week for you, and I am so grateful that you took time to come to our studio and to be on State of Belief Radio to enlighten and inspire our listeners. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's my privilege. God bless.
Here in America, in the weeks and months after September 11th, Muslim citizens who had absolutely no connection to al-Qaeda found themselves the victims of backlash simply because of their faith, a faith which is often seen as foreign and guilty by association and fundamentally un-American. Well, a new book, a very fine new book, hopes to counter some of the fears of Islam or of Arabs by examining the many ways Arab influences have actually shaped American culture. From food to literature to words like algebra or orange, these stories and more fascinating anecdotes than you can imagine are gathered in a new book called Al America, Travels Through America's Arab and Islamic Roots. The author is Jonathan Curiel, a staff writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. Jonathan now joins me by phone. Jonathan, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you for having me.
Your book, it's really something. It runs the gamut from Arab influences on American architecture to the English language to music. So I'm wondering, once you got started on this, did you see influences that you didn't anticipate, or did you start out knowing that you were going to find that much information?
No, I started out knowing a little bit of this information because I had written about it before for the San Francisco Chronicle. But I didn't know, as one particular example, I didn't know about the Alamo in San Antonio being influenced by Islamic architecture. I didn't know about New Orleans being influenced by Islamic design patterns. And it was only when I went to these cities that it occurred to me that there was probably a reference here, and that was because of the Spanish culture, the Spanish influence. And having done research at Oxford University, I knew perfectly well that when you think of Spanish influence, you often think of it's actually Islamic influence or a combination thereof. Mm-hmm. And so these two examples, New Orleans and San Antonio, were good examples of what I found along the way.
How difficult was it to get information like you found? I mean, it is indeed pretty much an untold history, as you've illustrated, and most of it was relegated to, I think these are your words also, obscure academic tomes and dusty library books. So you had your work cut out for you. How did you even know where to look?
Yeah, I did have my work cut out for me. A lot of the book is based on hunches. Huh. And again, I'd done research in England. I had a feeling, a fairly good feeling, that there were these influences. But again, going to these places made me realize, yeah, I think there is an influence here. But it was only when I went to these, dusty history books that I realized, wait a minute, here is a specific reference to Arabic, the Arabic language. Here's a specific reference to Islamic architecture. I put two and two together, as it were. And then I create a bigger picture. And these weren't isolated cases, by the way, either. And this is one of the astounding things of my book, I think. You have the Alamo in San Antonio. You have New Orleans, the so-called French Quarter, which is really should be thought of as the Spanish Quarter. And beyond that, a kind of Spanish, French, Muslim, Cajun Quarter, really. Mm-hmm. But you have all these other examples. And perhaps the most surprising, or maybe one of the most surprising, was going to Christopher Columbus himself. And I wanted to start at the start of this country's founding with Christopher Columbus. I had a feeling there were influences there because of his time in Spain. Mm-hmm. And there were influences there, and I was surprised at how deep they were. For example, with Christopher Columbus, it's not only language. And with Columbus, it's with the title, his very coveted title he had. That title is Almirante del Mar Oceana, which means Admiral of the Ocean Sea. Now, Almirante is from an Arabic word, Al-Amir, which means the commander. And this title was given to Columbus by Queen Isabella herself. So here was an example of how, despite the Reconquista, despite the fact that Spain purged Muslims from Spain, They actually embraced Arab and Muslim culture, and this is one of the contradictions that I wanted to write about in my book. And it wasn't just language with Christopher Columbus. It was navigational techniques that were perfected by Arabs and Muslims. And he specifically cites Muslims in his journals, credits them for aiding him on his journeys to the New World. This is something I had never, ever found in any history book. I found a particular quote in an English translation of a Spanish book. And as far as I know, a lot of the information in All America, in my book, has not really been known to the general public.
Jonathan, how in the world did you find out that an ice cream cone was actually invented by Syrian immigrants?
Well, this is actually something that had been written about before I researched my book. Several outlets had reported the ice cream cone as being connected to several Syrians, one of whom, Abe Dumar, came to this country before the 1904 World's Fair. Now, I interviewed Abe Dumar's descendants, and they told me a rather fantastical tale that hasn't been told before, and that is that the Dumar family came to this country before 1904, before the World's Fair in St. Louis. Abe Dumar was one of the people who were trying to sell goods there, and Abe Dumar was actually not selling ice cream cones. He was selling holy water from Jerusalem, from Israel and Palestine. Now, Abe Dumar also was familiar with the zalabia, this kind of waffle-like pastry that was also sold at the World's Fair. Now, next to Abe Dumar's concession was this ice cream stand. And in 1904 in America, ice cream was sold in cups and saucers. Now, that made for problems because if people walked away with those cups and saucers, there went a lot of the profit. Now, Abe Dumar recognized that wait a minute, what would happen if we rolled up this zalabia, these waffle-like pastries, into a conical shape, which is what they do in the Middle East. He was very familiar with this idea. He rolled up such a pastry into a conical shape after this ice cream stand next to him ran out of plates and saucers, and thus was born the ice cream cone. Now, Abe Dumar and, to some extent, Ernest Hamwi, another Syrian man who accompanied Abe Dumar to St. Louis, they are generally credited with inventing the ice cream cone and popularizing it in this country, Abe Dumar specifically. And I interviewed his descendants, and they told me one reason they came to this country in the late 1800s and early 1900s is because, you know, he was accused of a crime in Syria. Now, Abe Dumar is a Christian Arab man, and he was accused by another man in Syria of a crime. And if it wasn't for that accusation, the ice cream cone might not have been born as it was at the St. Louis World's Fair in 1904.
I mean, you must be really good at dinner parties.
That's good. Well, you know what? I think I've turned into a pretty good dinner guest. I'm taking invitations even as we speak. And a lot of this information does lend itself to these anecdotes. But I think they add up, and I say this in the book, I think they add up to a bigger picture of give and take between the America and the Arab and Muslim world, mm-hmm. in ways that a lot of us, including me before I wrote the book, don't know about.
Yeah. Jonathan, you talk about the fact that Islam and Sufi poetry in particular influenced a lot of early American writers, even writers like Emerson and Thoreau, but also that in that environment, Americans were standoffish about Muslims because most of what they knew about Islam was filtered through the lens of war. And reading that, I couldn't help but think about the perceptions of Islam today, which are disturbing, to say the least. What would you say to the American people based on what you learned then about perceptions of Islam now?
Yeah, this is a good question because this is an example of history repeating itself. In the 1800s, in the mid-1800s, as Ralph Waldo Emerson was studying Islam, studying Sufi poetry from Persia, America was having an antagonistic relationship toward the Muslim world, and that was mainly because of the Ottoman world, because of Ottoman Turkey. At that point, they had nominal control over the Holy Land, over Jerusalem. There was, of course, the spread of Islam through Europe. And so there was this idea of a clash of religions, of a clash of civilizations, as it were. But Ralph Waldo Emerson, you know, studied Islam, studied it through this book called The Practical Philosophy of the Mohammedan People. This came out in the year 1839. And as I point out in my book, this was a book that tried to look at the Muslim world through a lens other than violence. And there were reviews at the time, not only in the United States but in Europe, that said if we knew more about the Muslim world through books like this, through the Practical Philosophy of the Mohammedan People, there would be less a call for war with the Ottoman Muslim world. And at one point, a reviewer said, and in fact, we went to war on phony precepts, essentially, on the precept that Muslims were just totally violent and nothing else. Now, I think there is parallel to the present day. I think if more people, especially President Bush, had known more, knew more about the Muslim world, knew about it through other than violence, through other than the fundamentalism that exists there, and I think we're all against that fundamentalism. But I think if people knew more about that world, there would be more of an understanding of that world, and dare I say, more empathy for that world. I've lived in Pakistan. I've traveled a lot in the Arab and Muslim world. I've done stories on terrorism. I know that these stories are legitimate, but it doesn't mean that we can't have stories that talk about the other side of the Arab and Muslim world. This book is all about the other side. It's about Islamic architecture. It's about food and language and literature. And I really, really hope that if people read the book, they'll also be better educated and see the Arab and Muslim world for more than just religion, more than just violence, more than just fundamentalism, and more than just the headlines that we get every 5 minutes.
In 2011, Jonathan Curiel joined the staff of the Wikimedia Foundation as Development Communications Manager. His most recent book is Islam in America, published in 2015.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Once again, our best wishes to you and yours for a happy and healthy 2017. We face many unexpected challenges, but as we begin our 11th year of broadcasting, we'll continue doing what we've always done, focusing on hope and meaningful cooperation, encouraging understanding across religious and cultural divides, and raising up activists and advocates, leaders and community members who work across this nation every day for inclusion, mutual respect, and true religious freedom as outlined so eloquently in our precious Constitution. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. We rely on your support to be able to continue this important work. As we draw near to our 11th anniversary of continuous broadcasting next month, if you've heard something that you've found to be helpful, I urge you to share it with others who might also benefit from hearing it. It's easy to do that on Facebook and Twitter. You can also direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, all next year long, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
Was the son of a preacher man, the only boy who could ever teach me. Was the son of a preacher man, see what?